The following is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University.
I clerked from 2006 to 2007, so I just finished my clerkship in August.
Andrew Fody. I currently clerk for Judge Blackburn Rigsby on the D.C. Court of Appeals. Prior to that, I did a two-year clerkship on the Superior Court with Judge Macaluso and Family Court doing domestic relations and juvenile criminal.
Andrew, you want to start us off, I guess, speaking about you, that you haven't been in your current position that long because it's you're our appellate court representative. Tell us a little about as much as possible what a typical day might be like in Judge Blackburn or
Chambers. Sure. Although I haven't been there a very long time-wise, I guess in terms of days, I feel like I live there. It's a wonderful experience. Anything can happen on a daily basis. There are a lot of different calendars we deal with because in the District of Columbia, we don't have an intermediate court. So the Court of Appeals is the intermediate court and the Court of Last Resort. So we handle a lot of appeals as a matter of right, and then we handle some special appeals as well. So anything that comes from the Superior Court or any administrative agency or law judges, we get to hear on appeal. On a typical day, I'm reviewing cases, reading case law, and summarizing issues before the court. We get our calendars about a month in advance, and we start prep work, and every few days or so we're working on a new case. And I guess the biggest thing that we deal with is different standards of review for different cases, depending on whether or not the issue was originally raised on the trial court level or on the first time for appeal. And we see everything from family law, criminal law, civil to probate and professional responsibility. So it's a wide range, and you get a smattering of everything. There's no certain judges that handle certain kind of cases, so you have a very rich and fulfilling experience on that court.
Want me to go? Okay. Well, in contrast to that, Andrew was talking about an appellate court, a trial court clerkship and internship or whatever you do there is drastically different, not completely different, but substantially a lot different than an appellate court. An appellate court, I think Andrew would agree, is a lot of research and writing. You're dealing with one specific case a lot of times, seeing it through, you know, when it comes up, reviewing the record, doing that sort of thing, and then writing the opinion on it and helping the judge write the opinion or whatever. In a trial court, you're basically spending your days getting the judge ready for whatever they have on their docket that day. My judges weren't assigned to a specific family law or criminal or civil docket. They did it all. And so as a consequence of that, I got to see many different areas of law. Much of my work was focused on a daily basis, was prepping the judge for whatever was going to be before them either that day or that Friday on a motions day. So it could be all sorts of civil motions, all sorts of criminal things, sentencings, revocations, just a lot of different things, just a lot of interaction with attorneys, with pro se parties, people representing themselves and the public at large, as well as with the judges. So it was just kind of, you were all over the place.
I work for a trial court as well. I mean, it's federal trial court, so I guess the jurisdiction is a little different. But everything that has been just said from the research, the writing is all true, certainly in my experience. Some of the other duties that I think are common for trial judges, trial clerks, is dealing with the parties and dealing with whatever emergency walks in the door. That was always a lot of fun for me. Be able to call up, you know, partners at law firms and say, can I talk to big partner Jerry Bob? And may I ask who's calling? That's clerk for Chief Judge H.O. Fix. Hold on one moment, I'll get right on the phone. that's just kind of a story. But in doing that, I mean, you're suddenly thrust into a very professional situation where you have to obviously comport yourself as a professional because you are representing the court. And that's something very different maybe than representing a client. And I think it's certainly something very different from what I do now in private practice. And then kind of the emergencies that walk in the door. I mean, I'll never forget a divorce lawyer who came breaking into Judge Fish's chambers with a essentially some type of restraining order slash temporary something something. Now, federal courts don't have jurisdiction over these types of disputes. This individual eventually ended up having to face Rule 11 sanctions because he didn't quite grasp the nuances of federal jurisdiction. But it was very challenging to be in a situation where you have somebody who's very animated, very upset about something, representing their client, obviously in the wrong court in this instance, and then having to go back and talk to the judge about that. And you know, I was being very kind of flippant about it right now, but you have to. Again, comport yourself very professionally and say, you know, basically, look, Judge, we've got somebody out here who's just about ready to, you know, pull the wallpaper from the walls here, and we need to get rid of them. How do we do it? And, you know, and that, of course, gets shot back to you. Well, why don't you go figure that out, Eric? So, I mean, those are just some kind of stories, but that's, I think, a trial court is like that in many ways.
Brings me my favorite tip for never be rude to the law clerk. Whether you clerk or you don't, when you interact with Judge Chambers, it is part of, I mean, as a clerk, you have a relationship with the judge. I'm sure everyone would agree that if someone is obnoxious or rude to you, that's your relationship with the judge. You go back and you say, this person is just completely out of line, and it affects the way the judge deals with that, which is, I think, one of the interesting parts of clerking is realizing what goes on in chambers. The judges do hear about that stuff. But anyway, I clerked for a trial court in family court, which is where Andrew was at the time as well, but because my judge was the presiding judge, my duties were a little different because she had a lot of administrative jobs. She did chaired a lot of the committees, handled a lot of things like press wanting to come into proceedings, which is just really one law over and over and over, but you have to apply it to different situations. But she has to sign off because most family court proceedings are closed. So every time someone wants to come into a closed proceeding, it becomes matter of, you know, they meet the statutory standard. There's not an intermediary court in D.C., but magistrate judges, their decisions can be appealed to associate judges, and in the family court, that comes through the presiding judge. So it was neat because she was a trial judge, but also I did some sort of appellate work because you are reviewing magistrate judges' decisions. So there are a lot of interesting aspects to it, and I think that in D.C., every section, all there are, I think, 13 divisions, two superior courts, and every division has a presiding judge. So if there's a specific area you're interested in, family court, probate court, I know that judges are always interested in finding people who are really interested in their practice area, because that's so helpful. So going to an admitted one of the presiding judges and the deputy presiding judges, and being able to express that you really want to work, you understand that they don't have a trial calendar. And are still interested, I think that's always a great tactic to take. Maybe for the people, the 1Ls, 2Ls, who are probably still trying to decide if they want a clerk. They know it's a big process, takes a lot of work. Just talk a little bit about the benefits you found from clerking, and those of you that have moved on to the job after clerking, you know, if that helps you with that process. And, you know, to be fair, any drawbacks or disadvantages as well. So, you want to start?
Sure. I mean, I think clerking is great. It's great if you know exactly what you want to do, and it's great if you don't know exactly what you want to do, because it is an absolutely respectable way to spend a year or two. You'll get great experience. No one thinks it looks strange on your resume, and it's a job with an ending. I mean, it's not like you don't have to quit the job, you see, and your judge helps you generally move on to your next position. So I think if you are not exactly sure if you want to go to a firm or pursue something, it's a great way to sort of give yourself another year out in a field of practice. I did not intend to clerk. I wasn't sure if I was going to fess up to that or not, but I did not intend to pursue a clerkship. I pursued the fellowships instead, and the Equal Justice Works fellowships, and it didn't work out. So there I was in December of my third year with no plan B. I met with Shelley, and I was like, what do I do? And it really all worked out. I think a great way to get a clerkship is to network, both for summer internships and for clerking. If you know someone who's clerking and you want their job, their judge is going to love if their clerk can help them find someone, and someone who comes with a reference like that. Judges love that. It's a great sort of way to think about finding out the real dirt on what's going on.
Yeah,
that's
great. Yeah.
You know, you're going to hear all these stories if you haven't heard them all before about how great it is, and I think that's all right. I don't think it really, I need to repeat it. You know, just kind of globally, to me, I always think of, what's that, what is it, Wizard of Oz, with the Oz who had their curtains pulled back? That's how I always, that's what I got from it in a very global perspective from clerking. It's like, you know, we build up in law school this, the judges and robes and decorum and, you know, here, here, and all this kind of Latin stuff and all the rest of it. And so you build a kind of mystique around judges and the court, which I think is proper to an extent. But how it's helped me to have that screen pulled back or those curtains pulled back is that when I appear in court now or I'm dealing in a situation with the court, I know what's behind the curtain. And that gives me a certain level of confidence that I won't say that others don't have, but it's certainly given me that confidence. And that's invaluable to me in my practice. And also just to be able to say to somebody who's maybe more senior than you as far as years out of law school, be able to say, you know, when I was clerking, I remember we did it this way. Or that problem was dealt with that. And what does that mean? That imparts confidence to the people that you're working with. Hey, this person kind of knows what's going on. And it's for real. You know, this isn't all just, you know, smoke and mirrors. It's for real. But kind of, everything I think you're going to hear about clerking, with the one exception of, you know, these crazy judges that are just really very difficult, which I'm sure exist, those are the exceptions. The one downside to clerking, and I don't know if the panel will agree, but I've certainly talked to other people who would agree with me who clerk, is it's not the practice of law. And that maybe won't mean very much to you right now. It means more to me today than it did when I stopped. So you spend 1 year doing this, or two, or three, or whatever the number is. I mean, it's many things, but it's not practicing law. And so when you get out into whatever you're doing, whether you're helping remove landmines in Cambodia or helping move paper around for big corporations like I do, it doesn't necessarily equate to somebody actually being out there in the field, so to speak, doing the practice of law. And so as long as you kind of leave a clerkship knowing that, I think you do yourself a good turn. So as far as disadvantages, I think that's probably the only one I can think of.
Yeah, I would agree with that, actually, that it isn't the practice of law. You know, it does make you a lot more comfortable when you go out to practice law as far as appearing in court before a judge, because, you know, like you said, the veil's kind of been lifted, and you know what it's all about and what goes into it, and you've seen pleadings, and so that sort of thing really helps. But it isn't. At the same time, you know, I really enjoyed my clerkship. I think everybody does, unless you do have those occasional judges that are kind of crazy and, you know, make you go get their dry cleaning and walk their dog and stuff like that. But those are kind of few and far between, I think in general. Everybody really likes their clerkship. I found it to be really helpful to me in my practice because I just finished my clerkship in August, and now it's September and I've started a job at a private firm. We do a lot of work in the court where I clerked, and so a lot of people in the firm will come to me and ask me questions. Okay, well, I want to do a motion to reconsider. How is that done in this courthouse? Because you'll find when you're practicing, and if you're interested in trial work, different courts do things differently. So if you're in Arlington, a court's procedure for doing something might be this way. If you're in Fairfax, which is another jurisdiction, it might be a different way, and none of this stuff is written down. It's just kind of, you kind of have to know it. To be able to do it. So that's helpful, and it helps gain credibility with the people I'm working with, and I'm able to feel like I'm contributing, even though I feel like I'm behind the eight ball because I haven't been practicing for a year. At least I feel like I'm contributing a little bit to it. I thought I wanted to clerk, but I wasn't 100% sure, so I spent my second summer, between my second and third years, I did two different types of internships. I interned down at the Virginia Supreme Court for half my summer, and half my summer I spent interning at the Arlington Circuit Court, where I ended up clerking. Two very different experiences, and it helped me figure out exactly what was the right fit for me and what I wanted to do. I found that extremely helpful. So if you guys can do internships, especially during the school year, there's so many courts around here, it's definitely worth your while, because you'll not only figure out if it's the type of work you want to do, it's going to be a great experience regardless if you find out it's not. But you'll be able to figure out if it's the type of work you want to do and if it's the type of court you want to be in, and if it's, you know, the kind of people you like. So I would recommend internships if you can.
Kimberly, can I ask you one quick follow-up? Sure. If you work for a group of judges, uh-huh. What do you find to sort of be the benefits or challenges of that? There are positions like that in some courts or some where you work for a group.
Yeah. How my clerkship worked is there are four judges that sit at the Arlington Circuit Court, and there's three law clerks for all four judges. And so you share the judges, which is nice because you get to know four different judges, their different styles. So when you appear before any one of them, you kind of know what their tendencies are and what they like to see. At the same time, you work with the other two law clerks, and so you kind of have to all work together to make sure the job's getting done. And if one law clerk isn't pulling their weight, it comes down on the other two, and you have to pick up the slack. And there's really no way to kind of delegate individual responsibilities. We all had our caseloads and stuff, but we split the work every week. And if one person wasn't getting their work done, then you would have to pick up the slack, and the judge wouldn't necessarily know who wasn't carrying their workload. And, I mean, you didn't necessarily want to throw the other guy under the bus. But so that was kind of some of the challenges at the same time. One of the extreme benefits, though, to working with other people is that you had other people to go to ask questions before you went to the judge. So if you had something before you and you looked it up in the code book and you're just like, I have no idea what to do with this, you could go bounce it off to other people before you go to the judge and feel like you look like an idiot with an obvious question. So that was one of the benefits of it.
I'll agree with my panel members as far as it's not the actual practice of law, but I will say with one, I guess, caveat or qualifier, it is the art of litigation. And I think it's essential. If anyone you want to be in litigation, you should try your hardest to clerk. Because while you might go to a big firm and a firm has their way of doing things, when you're in court, you get to see everyone's way of doing things. And that experience is invaluable because not only do you get to see different trial methods, trial techniques, but then you get to hear from a judge what's been persuasive, what they like, and what trial techniques they hate. And while you're not practicing law while you're in your clerkship, I don't know, there's some ridiculous 80 or 90% of all cases these days settle before they even get to court. So while you're at a fancy law firm, if they let you at least go and hold their briefcase and go to court with them, they might go one or two times a year, maybe three or four if they're lucky, if they're in a high litigation practice. You can be in court at a trial court almost every single day. And I sat on a calendar, and I'll speak to the Court of Appeals in a second, but I sat on a trial court calendar where we handled 750 cases and over 1,500 hearings in 1 year. And even though you're not actually there arguing before the court, the pattern, the rhythm, the speech, it just gets ingrained in your head. So you might be sitting, you might wake up one night from a dream and just like start spouting out someone's closing argument just because it's in there, it's in your head, and it's not your own words, but you just make it your own, and it shapes you. And it just to echo the pulling the cover back on the Wizard of Oz, it's like another way to look at it is taking the back off a watch and really seeing how everything breaks down, how everything gets to the court and gets to the trial level, and then you build a record, and then which brings me up to the Court of Appeals. I would say if you're interested in litigation, you know trial court is a great way to go. But if you don't know if you're interested in litigation, or you might want to go into academia, or you are interested in litigation, you can never go wrong with the Court of Appeals job, because it is more academic. It is sitting around reading a lot of cases, becoming an expert in one tiny facet of the law. The only problem is if you haven't been to the trial court level, you don't know where that one little facet fits into the whole trial, because you're only looking at one small issue. So I can't say which is better. But, I mean, they both give you little nuggets and little insights into the practice of law, even though you're not technically practicing. And I know the question was about the 1Ls and 2Ls who are thinking about clerking. I'd say there's no better thing to do than intern at a court, because it will give you a little insight. Now, granted, you're not the person. It will be a lot more stressful and a lot more challenging being the clerk than it is being the intern, because ultimately the buck stops with the clerk. So no matter how much you're working, the clerk is behind you checking over and ultimately responsible. So if you don't like what you do as an intern, or you're too stressed out by what you do as an intern, that's a good indicator that you might not like it as a law clerk, because it's going to be that plus 10,000, because that's how much work you're going to have. On the trial court, there's only one clerk per chambers. On the Court of Appeals, you have two clerks. So you have the ability to bounce it off co-clerks in the Court of Appeals, but on the trial court, everything stops with you. If you are not going to intern with a court, the other great way to get a clerkship with the court is in one of the two big institutions, whether that's PDS or the U.S. Attorney's Office. I mean, when a judge sees that on your resume, it goes a long way, because those two institutions are always before the court, and there's a great reputation with both of those institutions. They write good briefs, they have outstanding lawyers, and you're automatically associated with them. So either intern with the court or intern with U.S. Attorney's Office or PDS if you can. And also, if you're not, I mean, everyone knows their own abilities, where they rank in their class, what their strengths are, whether or not they will qualify for the summer. But even if you don't get a summer internship, do it in the fall or the spring, where the applicant pool isn't as large. You still get the same amount of experience, if not more. And just having it on your resume and finding out whether or not you like it is a good thing, because once you're committed to a year, you're married to that judge, and that judge is going to follow you the rest of your life. They're always going to give you a recommendation, and while most judges will not sit there and badmouth you or give you a negative recommendation, it's all about the strength of their positive recommendation. So if it's not a good experience and you don't pair yourself well with your judge, that's always going to be looming over you for your next job. So kind of segueing in, if you have a number of offers, which all you go to American, so you should, really think about the judge and really think about the individual personality of the judge and whether that meshes with you, because it's a close, tight quarters, and you guys are going to be next to each other arm in arm. You know, you're the right-hand man or right-hand woman of the judge for a year, and that really carries a lot of weight. I know we're going to talk about mentors, so I'll just kind of cut it off right there and send it back down.
You mentioned, you alluded earlier to sort of your process. If you could tell us a little bit about how many judges you applied to, you know, sort of how you decided where to apply and how it went from there.
I mean, I did not start looking for a clerkship until late in the game. If you're sure you want to do a clerkship, I think you start much earlier in your third year. It was just January of my third year when I started. And I was not willing to leave D.C. and very much wanted to stay in the area. I only applied to D.C. Superior Court clerkships. And then I applied to pretty much every judge that was still accepting applications at that point, because frankly, you make mail merge and it's not that hard once you're involved in address. But I was most interested in family court, because family law is what I'm interested in. And I think if you have a practice area that's really where you're headed, it is worth doing some research on the judges and sort of seeking them out at various trial court levels. I think that it went a long way when I was interviewing with my judge and going through the process that this was the system I was planning to stay in long term. She understood that I was really interested in what she did and the cases that would be before her, and I think that mattered, because family law you either love or hate. You know, it's one of those practice areas. I'm sure everyone in this room is either like, yeah, no way, I would never touch family law, or it's what you came to law school for. And it doesn't do a judge any good to have someone clerking for them who doesn't care about their cases or isn't interested. They're much better off getting someone who is really interested. And I had a domestic violence background and a family law background, and you know, she told me later that that was pretty much what sealed the deal for her, was that I was so interested in that. The other part of my process was that I started talking to professors and talking to career services about who they knew who was currently clerking. And one of my professors put me in touch with the current clerk for the judge who eventually became the judge I clerked for. And I called her and said, listen, I've applied to your judge, but I would just love to go to coffee and talk about your experience. But I'm still unsure if I wanted to clerk at that point. And I went out to lunch with Kim Boonalim from here, and we talked. And within an hour or two, I got a call from the judge asking me to come in for an interview. I didn't even realize it was on a job interview. And the next thing, so I think that's another tip, is in your interactions with chambers, it's all a job interview. The secretary, the law clerk, most judges ask the opinions of their current law clerk. For the clerk, when my judge was interviewing at the end of my term, at the end of every interview, she would bring the candidate back to my office and say, oh, well, why don't you sit here and ask Damon if you have any questions? And I think the impression is it was for me to answer their questions. Really, at the end of it, the judge would ask my impression. They wanted to know, and I would ask questions like, you know, how organized are you? And the response was, well, organized, and I'm like scratching your name off the list. That's not the right answer. I think most law clerks are really organized, because frankly, most judges aren't.
Yeah.
They don't have to be. That's why they hire us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, keep in mind as you apply. If you are organized, you can say that in your interview, because most judges know that that's a weakness they have.
I did all this in 2001, I guess, or 2001. Process has changed quite a bit, I think, with this Oscar and all the rest of it. I mean, just to maybe retrace to the extent it's relevant here, I did what some of the panel had talked about here. On my first summer out of law school, I clerked for the D.C. Court of Appeals, which is, as everyone has said, the appellate court here, and quickly found out that I wasn't interested in that monastic lifestyle. Decided that I was going to do a trial court because I did want to do litigation and I only wanted to do federal court. And so that right there narrows it down. I wasn't interested in a state court for various reasons. I'm from Texas, born and raised, and went to undergraduate there. So that was kind of easy for me. I just said, I want to go to Dallas. So I applied to 22 judges in Dallas in the Northern District and a handful of judges here. And got the interviews and made a choice from there. Thinking back on it, I'm surprised that I didn't do just like everywhere else. I'm two minds of the shotgun, send out a million different resumes and applications and just hope that one sticks. However, I think, again, thinking back on what I did, I was probably too narrow and maybe taking hoping that I was going to hit one of these 22. Luckily, I did. But that was more the free market system back then when it was, you just kind of, I think I started my second semester.
February of your second year?
Yeah. Yeah.
It used to be that you applied February of your second year. Now it's September of your third year.
Yeah, so it was, and there was no rhyme or reason. You just applied to whoever. And as far as looking at judges, I'm not here to talk politics to anybody, but I know a lot of people focus on that. I don't. People may differ with this, but I think judges are, by and large, they take their jobs fairly seriously. And so some of you may have very strong political beliefs left or right, and sometimes maybe you can tell something about that type of person. But I did not do that. I know some people have said, I'm only going to work for somebody who's a Democrat appointee or a Republican appointee or what have you. I'll obviously leave it up to you guys, but I have found that there's really no correlation between the way judges act and certainly the way they interact with their clerks, let alone their parties, based on whether they have an R or D after their name. But I think we're going to talk a little bit about the mechanics and nuts and bolts of some of the process, but I'm probably not the person to talk too much about it because it was so long ago. Speaking.
Yeah, I guess with my application process, I had originally thought that I would go through the Oscar and try and do the federal thing. Then, it was the beginning of the third year, and there was so much involved in that, and I'm going to be really honest, and I think I was a little lazy. And I was just like, well, I wasn't really sure if federal thing was what I wanted to do, especially because I interned in state court, knew I wanted to do litigation, knew I wanted to do a trial court, so I just kind of bailed on the whole Oscar thing and just focused my search for my clerkship on state trial court. And I applied to the ones in Northern Virginia because I knew I wanted to practice in Virginia. And obviously, I had interned in Arlington and so got an offer there. But because of my experience, I got interviews at other courts as well. And so the internship thing goes a long way, I think, with courts when you're applying. But that was basically my process. That was all there was to it.
I'll just focus on, I guess, other aspects of it. Researching the judge, or actually I'll start with who to apply to. It really, unless you've truly researched the judge beforehand, it really is going to be hit or miss based on who you're going to get an interview with. It doesn't have much, it has something to do with merit, but there has to be something that sticks out in the judge's mind about why you'd be a good candidate, not just because of your grades, your academics, your writing. That's all. You have to figure that everyone else is going to have the same qualifications you have. But what makes you stand out, and why is the judge going to like to be with you for a year? And that really, in a lot of instances, determines who's going to interview you. So that's why you shouldn't take it personally. If you applied to 500 judges and only got one interview or two interviews, it's just the one that sticks. And the job you get, it doesn't matter how many you apply to. So while I say, don't necessarily blanket the whole United States, but the more you apply to, sometimes the better chances you have for, you know, one of the judges to find something about you that they like and then call you in for an interview. Depending how much time you have, I'd say research the judges before you apply. That way you can put more in your cover letter directly to that judge. But if you can't, before you go there, learn everything you can about that judge. There should be a give and take between your interview. You should be spending a lot of time talking, but you should also be asking the judge a lot of questions about him or herself and really engaging them so it's more of a conversation. You turn it around so you're not under fire defending why you should get the job. You turn it into a conversation, and if you're able to do that, chances are you're going to get the job because you have this dialogue going, and judges like dialogue. They like speaking. They don't like the tell me about this, tell me about that, tell me about your resume. A back and forth is really good. It's easier on the Court of Appeals to research opinions that judges have written. Don't go in there saying, well, I think I'd be good for you because I've read this opinion and I know how you think. Because for each individual opinion, they can be thinking something differently. But at least you can go in with general statements. I see the writing process. I see how you organize your thoughts. I see this, I see that, and I think I can help or I can aid in this way. If there's not a lot about them because they're on Superior Court and most of their opinions aren't published, look into what they did before they became a judge. Talk about that. Find out where they went to law school. The more information you know, even if you never talk about it, at least you're armed with it. You feel more comfortable and confident. Just a quick, I guess, anecdote. When I interviewed with Judge Macaluso in the Superior Court, she took one. I don't even know why she gave me an interview, to tell you the truth, because she sat me down and she didn't even ask my name. Her first question to me was, what are you doing in my chair? This is a family court. Everything on your resume screams business and business law. Do you want me to call some of the other judges and see if I can get you an interview there? I'm like, well, let's get this one. And then I just realized that she just wanted to know that somebody was interested in family law, and I truly was. And I just had to show her that while I have short blurbs on my resume that screams business, it's not always that case. Like, some of the things on there that are business related are actually a contingency fee and helping out indigent people or pro se clients. And even though it says civil clinic, I actually dealt with three out of four of my cases were all family law, and I do have a genuine interest. One thing I also want to note or point out is that even if the judge is currently on a calendar that you're interested in, especially in criminal and civil, the judges, and I'm only speaking about Superior Court, the judges can rotate if they want every year. So it might not be a bad thing to put in your cover letters that, you know, I understand the process. While you might be on criminal one now, and I'm very interested, and that's my primary focus, I would not be opposed to working in other aspects of the law. I'm truly in this for litigation because there's a possibility you might go to civil next year or speak to their law clerks before you write the cover letter and ask, is there any indication that your judge might move off the calendar? That way you're armed with the most knowledge that you can have and you can kind of hedge your bets and give yourself the best chance of getting the job.
Anyone else have anything they sort of noticed either at the fact of their own process or if you took part in reviewing applications, mistakes people made, or things that sort of made a difference for applicants?
I mean, us as law clerks at the court I clerked at, we reviewed all the applications for interns and for law clerks before it ever went to a judge. For interns, we were solely responsible for hiring interns, the law clerks were. The judge never even saw the resume and never even saw the candidate until it was their first day of work. So they left that completely up to us. It was their view that the interns worked for us and we had to work with them, so they didn't really care as long as we were happy. With the law clerk process, we got all the applications in and reviewed them and then made recommendations to the chief judge. The applicants would then come in, interview with the law clerks and the chief judge, and then if they successfully made it past that round, they would interview with the other judges on the circuit. But some of the mistakes, two-page cover letters, two-page resumes. I'm sorry, unless you've really done, you know, had this huge career before law school and that you need to highlight, I really think if you fit it on one page, fit it on one page. Same thing with the cover letter. People are getting so many of these things. You just got to kind of nail it down, hit it on the head with what you can bring. Try to put some personality into the cover letter. Typos. Don't have typos. And also, if you're doing like the mail merge kind of thing, you're just going to want to make sure that, you know, the areas that you put to a specific court actually are to that court. So you're like, oh, you know, I think I would fit in well at the Maryland Court of Appeals, and you're applying to a Virginia trial court. I mean, that's just, I mean, those we would just put to the side. So we're like, that's it, no attention to detail. And so, and you, it would be amazing. You would see a lot of those, and you would kind of see some of them coming from more schools than others, and it was kind of interesting. So,
no, actually,
WCLs were pretty good. So that's what I would say to definitely typos, one page cover letter, one page resume, and try and show some personality in your cover letter. Highlight things that aren't necessarily on your resume, because your resume is there for a purpose, but your cover letter is there to actually show a little bit about who you are and your personality. So if you can bring that through, I would recommend that a lot. Something that would grab the reader.
I know a lot of people have gotten jobs just because they put in the cover letter they like to run. The judge isn't having a runner. I mean, little things like that will really get you the interview. Piggybacking on that, it's not just typos, because most people can know how to check for typos and spell check, and they have a friend read it. It's grammar. And that seems so basic, like fourth and fifth grade with grammar. But unfortunately, with all the radios and the blogs and the instant messenger, I mean, I'll say it generally, our generation is awful with formal writing. We write how we speak, and it seems like stream of conscious when I see a lot of these cover letters. You know, I want to be this because of that, and I think I would be a great because of this, that, this, and other, which sounds great when you're talking, and it sounds great when you're reading it in your head, but it doesn't look good to a neutral eye. And really just think about that when you're actually writing these. If you're going to join sentences, you have to have a comma before the end. If you have however, you know, set it off with commas. I mean, commas, it's just unbelievable how little you think it matters, but especially on the Court of Appeals, where everything they do is a written product, and they're judged by that, and how embarrassing it is to be on Lexis or Westlaw with a typo or with a comma out of place, because maybe not on the lower end, but the upper end practitioners, they read it, and they read it not just for the opinion, but they read it for the writing, the grammar, and it's very important to the judges because they can't sit there and read over every single word that you write. They're reading it for context. And if you miss those commas, or if you miss the semicolons or the quotes, or you're not careful with your sight checking, it really makes a difference. And a judge isn't going to know that before she or he hires you. So they look to your cover letter. They look to your writing sample. And just because it was your first year writing, you know, if you want to submit your first year writing sample, and maybe you got an A on it for writing, look over it again. Change it again. Because it's your writing sample. It's not what you submitted for school now. So it can't be, oh, I was the first year then, and my writing's gotten a lot better. Well, if your writing's gotten a lot better, then you can even change your sentences around later on. Because you're not submitting it as your first year writing assignment. You're submitting it as your writing sample. So really go over with a fine-tooth comb. If you know anyone who is an English major, become friends with them now. And really pick their brain and really make sure that every sentence is short, concise, and not just that it sounds good in your head, but that it actually looks good on paper and it's actually grammatically correct.
I'm just interested to do something that makes you stick out. Don't go too far. Don't be cute. Don't be zany.
Yeah.
These are still professional. I mean, you want to stand out, but you don't want to be trying too hard.
Yeah, don't be the resume that everybody runs, or the cover letter everybody runs around the office and saying, oh my God, read this. So.
And I know you just got this packet from Shelley. Don't copy the wording exactly. All of the cover letters from one particular local school, not ours, had the exact same wording. They had clearly gone to their clerkship panel and then used, you know, I am very committed to fill in the blank. And this was for the internship. I mean, I could tell they had all gone to the same workshop and they had all filled in their cover letter. I don't know if you guys saw it. And it was like, it wasn't badly written, but it was clear to me that they didn't write it. So people are very helpful. Start there, but resist the urge to copy the wording exactly.
In short, Eric, you're giving me that. You don't have to.
Yeah, don't make a mistake.
I have more questions, but since we only have 10 or 15 minutes left, I want to see if you guys have any questions. Yes.
Yeah, are there any classes you would recommend taking that would kind of appeal to a judge. I was thinking like appellate advocacy or Fed courts or any other recommendations. You want them to see your transcript and say, okay.
I think if that's the kind of court you're thinking about going to, I think absolutely it would help. I think it just depends on the kind of court you're going to and where you're going to. You know, courts vary almost as much as law jobs vary with kind of what they do and what they specialize in or if they're general. So if you know you want to go to a federal one, absolutely. I don't think it could hurt at all.
And I think if you're interested in D.C. Superior Court, doing a clinic and practicing in D.C. Superior mm-hmm. Court. I mean, it kind of goes both ways. Obviously, we're saying, oh, do a clerkship. So when you go to practice, you can say you've had that experience. I think also being able to say, I've been in a, you know, to a judge, I've already been in a courtroom. I'm a third-year law student, but I understand what happens in this courthouse. Go that direction as well.
Also, just one more quick thing to add on to that. You know, when you apply, you have to have actual letters of recommendation, and some of those need to be from professors. So another thing to think about is when you're taking classes, don't just take all huge classes with professors. You know, don't have a chance to get to know every student. Try to take some smaller classes or try to work with a dean fellow. Like, keep in mind that as a rising 3L, you're going to be having to ask people to write letters about you, and the more detailed they are, the better. So sometimes people get to that summer before their last year. They have a certain relationship, and it's hard at that point to fix them. So it's something good to think about, as much as you can, to take some smaller classes.
I had a question sort of related to his. When you guys receive an application, how closely do you scrutinize the courses that an applicant's taken? And more specifically, I know that taking evidence is extremely important, particularly if you're going to be a district court or a trial-level clerk. I'd really like to avoid taking evidence with a certain professor in this school, and that would probably mean waiting until my third year. Hypothetically, but in essence, if I don't have evidence on my transcript when I send out this application, is that going to rebut negatively, or should I say in my cover letter, by the way, I'm going to take it, you know, whatever.
I would point it out. I wouldn't make an issue of it. I would not waste a line of my cover letter telling them what I didn't do. It's hard to say. I mean, I definitely look to see when I'm reviewing these. I look to see your overall GPA, and then look to see your grades in the specific courses that affect the court. I don't know that anyone's gonna not hire you because you haven't taken evidence yet, especially if you're rising 3L. There's always the opportunity that you're taking it that coming year. I don't know if anyone has a different.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the transcript is kind of the third thing I would go to when I was reviewing. You know, obviously cover letter first, resume second, and then you would look to make sure that the transcript coincided and jived with what they were saying in the cover letter. Like, oh, I'm interested in litigation, you know, I want to do that sort of thing. So then you'd look to see if those types of courses in there, or if it was just filled with intellectual property and, you know, something else, like business law, and something that wasn't necessarily related to litigation, which was still probably fine, but you would just kind of check that. So I agree. You know, I wouldn't point it out, and I don't think it's that big of a deal.
I went through that some courses require evidence as a prerequisite. So I was just asking Dana about clinics. It's not a rule that you take it at the same time, but if there's a clinic you may want to think about it for other reasons too.
No, we're not judging you for.
We all understand.
We all understand.
Although I will say I've worked with a former clerk at D.C. Superior Court who got a very low grade from that professor and still went on to be a clerk. So it's not to say it can't be done, but there's another question in the back.
I feel like I hear from everyone that regardless what you want to do, clerking is like a positive, you know, addition to your resume. But does that include international work? Like, if I can't decide if I want to go into the international field or, like, the criminal field for, like, the same area, does it still help me if I want to eventually work for, like, the UN or Human Rights Watch or something of that nature to clerk? Or not so much?
I think it's certainly never going to hurt you. I mean, no one is ever going to look at a clerkship on your resume and go, oh, no, we're not hiring someone to clerk. And I think if you're interested in sort of both criminal stuff and international law, getting that practical on the ground criminal experience is a great way to market yourself to a human rights group later, I think, and say, I fully understand the criminal system. I have that legal, you know, I clerked for a criminal law judge.
I would say that anything you do with the Court of Appeals is going to benefit you and help you in your next job search because of the reading and writing that is involved. Even if you work on international law, you still have to know how to form a brief, make paragraphs that gel together, and you can never have enough writing is what I'm trying to say. And so learning and understanding that process on any one of these courts is going to be a benefit, because what you can always say is, even if it wasn't international law that I was doing at this court, I was learning a process. And now that I know the process, I can apply that to any subject matter. I am proficient in litigation. Just because I'm not proficient in the subject matter you deal with, I'm confident that the skills I have will transfer over to your subject matter. Give me a little time, let me research your specific subject matter, and I'll be up to speed, and I'll be everything that you're looking for in it.
Yeah, or just go work for The Hague.
Yeah.
I have a friend who just got a job at the War Crimes Tribunal Rwanda for the, I think that's in a year, or it's, I don't think
I
it's a new
job.
But she got that job. To the extent that that's international law, I mean, I understand international law to be two things, arbitration and human rights. I mean, that's a simplification, but I think one that you can work with. And so if it's in the human rights, you should go work for The Hague, go work for one of these international tribunals. See no reason why you necessarily have to kind of sneak up on it. If that's what you want to do that.
And there are some, I can't remember what some of the courts are. Most international courts have a part of their website because they're in the process. Some hire really ridiculously far in advance, like 2 years in advance. So if there are courts of interest, look and see, because I feel like there was one of the courts in Africa had a 2 year in advance, and some of them don't pay. You can apply for fellowships to cover, and so it can be, they definitely are available. I think they often get overlooked because this process is not as, you know, as common. And there's also, I just want to add, it doesn't sound like this is what you were interested in, but there's a Court of International Trade in New York. We've had a couple of alums recently clerk there, which I don't think that's the type of international law you were referencing, but that's the one court where you would get, obviously, direct experience with trade.
I had an internship over the summer with a judge, and as far as the writing sample goes, I've been submitting, part of our appellate briefs we did last year. But if I have an opinion that I wrote that I really like, that where the judge didn't substantially change a whole lot, would it be okay to submit that and tell them, or are they going to assume that the judge kind of had too much of a hand in it?
I would check with the judge that you wrote it for and clear it through them before you use it.
And then would I have like a cover letter saying?
You'd have a cover letter. I would put a cover letter on it. Explaining
and,
it.
Right, and I would indicate that you cleared it with the judge.
Absolutely.
Because it almost looks bad if you don't. They're going to wonder if their colleague knows you're submitting something with their name on it.
Right.
And I would definitely redact the vital information out. I think, especially on the Court of Appeals, we're probably looking for substantive writing samples that were not what you did in law school. If you have one of those, I think it adds a lot of benefit. And you just put on the front that you can be honest with it, even though this has been edited by other people, this clearly and accurately represents my thoughts, my original work, and some of the words have changed, but it's still mine. And make sure you clear that with the judge and be honest with yourself. How much did she really change it, or he really change it? And then I, as long as your judge signs off on it, I think it's a much better product because it had applicable effect. It was something that was used in a court, submitted to a court, submitted an opinion by a court. I think that has a lot more weight when we're reviewing those than a first year or a second year assignment, because 10 people are going to read the same thing, slightly differently worded, but 10 people are going to submit that. I'm going to read it over and over again, and they're all going to kind of blend together, whereas if you have something that comes from a judge, or comes from, not from a judge, but comes from you while working for a judge, I think that's another way to separate yourself from everybody else.
Can I make one practice point?
Sure.
You know, I, I've seen this used effectively, and I believe it's effective with writing samples. And what you're talking about introductions, and I think it's very effective, whatever your writing sample is, to have a very concise one-paragraph summary of your writing sample that usually begins something like, this writing sample excerpts, da-da-da-da-da. And what's helpful is if you look at any cases, you know, the synopsis at the top of the cases, you can think about your writing sample in that way and write that synopsis. I think that's an excellent way to have somebody read something you wrote that summarizes a legal point or a legal question and doesn't require them to read 15 pages or to have a background in the latest EPA regulations and what the Supreme Court has said about that. And I have seen that in private practice, admittedly not the form that we're talking about here, but people are busy and they don't want to read 15 pages of your law note, which is probably excellent, but they're not going to read it. Mm-hmm. But if you give them an excuse to read something, which is your summary, I think that's very effective. And also it helps you, I mean, you talk about a writing sample, if you can condense 15 pages into a paragraph, that says something for your abilities. We do live in a society that values brevity.
Especially judges. Yeah, mm-hmm. you will summarize 15 pages into one paragraph a lot.
Because I think the application process is not an application process. I think it's a giant writing sample from the address on the front to the, you know, CC on the back or whatever it is on your letter. And so it's not just the cover letter. It's not just your writing sample. Everything. So the minute they open that application letter electronically or with their Yale letter opener they got when they graduated back in 67, you want it to be a writing sample from the get-go because that is, unfortunately, I think, your first impression.
If you intern in state court and then try to get it, does that make it more difficult to get a clerkship in federal court or vice versa?
I don't think so. I think maybe if you're trying to do, I'll use Texas as an example. If you're coming from the various state appellate, Texas state courts, I think that's almost an easy fit because it's a small world and people. Know one another, and it's very easy. My judge was a state appellate judge before he was elevated to the bench, so he was very familiar with the state practice, had valued people who had experience in state practice, and, you know, talked all the time with his colleagues who were still on the state court, and so it was like, oh, I've got this, you know, gal, it's really great, you know, why don't you talk to her? Okay. Now, if you're coming from Idaho to Delaware, I don't know how that works. I mean, I guess there'd be less of a relationship, but then again, a small world, so... From my experience in dealing with applicants, that was viewed favorably.
Absolutely. I saw all the time we would get applicants from not only other state courts, but other who did Eastern District of Virginia with, you know, Judge Lee and vice versa. And Judge Lee is very close with several of the judges on my circuit. And the judges' circle, like within the state of Virginia, I know, or the Commonwealth of Virginia, the judges' circle is very small. And when they get on the bench, they can't really do social things with other lawyers like they used to. And they can't do political things, and there's all these restrictions. And so when the judges get together at conferences and stuff, they're just, it's just a small group of them, and they talk a lot. They're very gossipy. So they talk a lot. So it would be a good thing, I think.
And echoing that in D.C., there are at least three active judges right now on the federal district court who came from Superior Court. And everyone always remembers their roots, remembers where they came from, and it's always going to strike a chord with them, so never a bad idea.
In the same respect, if you intern for a trial court judge, I mean, it wouldn't help for, you know, other than there are differences, you can market yourself and the pluses of the internship, you know, faithful translate. Any other questions?
It is an advantage, I'd just like to say, if you intern with the Court of Appeals and then apply to the Superior Court.
I see the strong, I mean, in terms of when I look at people who got clerkships, in terms of people who interned within the D.C. system who got clerkships there, it's, you know, 50%, I feel like, at least. And I think it's just because, you know, there's just such a tradition of WCLs applying interns there, and people do well, and their judges recommend them. And although the process, just the interning is one of the things I know on a list in this packet always increase your chances. You know, the clerkship process can be somewhat unfair, somewhat arbitrary, but it's one of the main things that I've seen that can make a big impact. Not that every clerk interns, they definitely have it. It's just because you're not going to intern doesn't mean you can't clerk, but it's definitely a great way to increase your chances.
deep Superior Court really does like them. I mean, I say this not just because I work there, but because, I mean, I was the third or fourth law clerk in a row from DV clinic to WCL to my judge. They know that we get, especially our clinical programs, our appellate advocacy programs, they appreciate that. They know that locally the clerks hit the ground running.
So don't mess it up.
Yeah, just one, you know, I think what's been a theme here is, you know, it's about the people you know and making connections. And it was said to me a long time ago in a different situation, and I've followed it for 15 years now, is that every time I meet someone professionally or even maybe socially, and there's an exchange of business cards or there's here's my phone number written on the back, I have taken that and made a little note to myself. Oh, well, this is Shelley, who's head of the recruitment, judicial recruitment. I'm now here. I mean, it sounds kind of silly. If you put that stuff in a folder and you kind of keep track of it through the years, it's amazing how helpful that can be. Because this is a small world. And it was said to me a long time ago, again, in a different situation, you know, look around at the people you're with because these are the people you're going to be bumping into for the rest of your professional life. And so get to know them. And, you know, maybe some of them you don't like, maybe some of them you do.
Better or worse.
Yeah. And so, you want to get a clerkship and you're in a big class of evidence because everybody's fleeing Professor Rice, who I think is an excellent professor, go up to that professor and say, I want to apply for a clerkship and I know I'm in a class of 100, so what can I do in order to get a good letter of recommendation from you? And of course he or she's going to say, get an A, but then you'll be connected with that person who gets an A. You're not coming in afterwards and say, hey, I got an A, can you write a letter for a recommendation? So do that. I mean, the professors here want you to get a clerkship. They really do. And tell them that you want it. That's what I did.
And I mean, your judge is going to want to help you in the same way.
Yes.
I mean, I hope everyone would agree that. I mean, I'm not at a firm. I'm at the medical office. And my judge absolutely helped me get this job. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I'm now in the same courtrooms in the family court that, you know, were before her. And she was, I mean, I kind of went to her and said, I'm thinking of this. What do you think? And then she was on board. She's like, who can I call? Who can I, you know, how can I help? And I think that that's another, to know that if you make contact with a professor here to help you get a clerkship, your judge is going to help you get your next job.
Maybe even the one after that.
Keep going. So.
Yeah, it becomes like a little family. And after a year or 2 years or however many you do with them, it's such a mentorship program. And you can always go back to them. And you can always search their wealth of knowledge because if nothing else, you're just, you know, a lawyer talking to another lawyer. It doesn't have to be a specific case before them, and they can talk in the abstract. And it's just really nice to have because you're not going to have that kind of, I mean, don't get me wrong, they'll I don't want to say yell at you, but they'll be upset when you let them down just like they will at a big firm. But I think there is a little more coddling that goes on in a court clerkship. I think there's more one-on-one, and even though you have a quote-unquote mentor in a firm, the judges who are on the bench aren't there for the money. They're there because they have, you know, the sense of civic duty, the sense of pride, the sense of the law. And while I'm not going to say lawyers in the big firms or whatever medium-sized firms don't have that, you're guaranteed that the judge on the bench will have that. And you're guaranteed to get neutral, unbiased information from that judge, and they'll help you out for the rest of your lives. Can't emphasize clerkships enough.
Thank you all. Thank you everybody for coming. Join me in a round of applause.